Well, hey, this is your old friend Bill. Whenever I find myself in Davis, I'm busy putting the fun in fundraising. But when I'm not, I always listen to KDVS 90.3 FM. And you should too. Go Aggies!
This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to Radio Parallax. Now, I must confess something. The last two programs were pre-recorded. I was vacationing for the past 2.5 weeks, and I'd like to thank special student correspondent Steve Valentino for going into the booth and playing that show, and thanks, too, to sound engineer Edward McMillan for putting this show together for Steve to play, and thanks to the staff down at KDVS for their usual assistance in production. You know, they say it's hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame, and I think that when it comes to news, you sometimes get a very different and perhaps clearer perspective when you are out of the United States. I found that when I took a trip abroad in the late 80s, I was never so well informed about events in the U.S. as when I was out of the U.S. During this trip, I took along a lot of reading material, a variety of materials, as varied as Fortune magazine and Mother Jones magazine, New Scientist, Discover, The Economist. When you're going to a place like Dominica and Tobago, which I did on this trip, you should take along a lot of reading material because there's no guarantee you're going to be able to find stuff to read in places like that. I read quite a bit, digested quite a bit, and I'm going to report on some of these findings during the next couple shows. We're going to get into a lot of it today. But I want to start off noting that in my absence the past couple weeks, there have been several bits of disastrous news that we need to address. Our space shuttle, the Columbia, was lost while returning to Earth on its most recent mission. We need to talk about that. The war drums are being beaten now with some degree of determination. When I left in mid to late January, it appeared quite obvious that war was going to be put off until February or March. That now looks like it's going to be the timetable, so we need to talk about that. And the third disaster we probably need to address is the fact that in Israel, the Ariel Sharon Likud government was reelected. Let's take up the matter of war first off. Now, in this program, we like to point out, and we're certainly encouraged by the fact that we are not alone in pointing out the fact that the United States was attacked on September 11th by al-Qaeda, headed by Osama bin Laden. The search for bin Laden goes on. But he seems to be a forgotten man as we now focus on what's going on in Baghdad with weapons inspectors, and we seem determined to go in and claim the Iraqi oil fields, quote, for the benefit of the Iraqi people, unquote, according to Colin Powell. You know, talking to people overseas, I got to tell you, there is a complete clarity of thought and focus on the fact that a war with Iraq is all about oil. A significant number of people in this country feel the same way, but it probably isn't a majority. But I'd say overseas, that's the way everybody looks at what's about to happen. Now, there were hints before I left that the timetable was being pushed back. This seems to be confirmed by what I read in The Economist, January 25th, 2003. The British, of course, Tony Blair's government seems to be the only government of any significance in the world that appears ready to back up the Bush administration on its desire to go to war. The Economist was pretty clear on the fact that the British were not quite ready, and that it seems clear the U.S. is not going to go it completely alone. We need to have at least the appearance of some sort of coalition. So, although about a quarter of the British Army is involved, actually a force larger than they sent to the Gulf before the war in 1991, it's clear they're not going to be ready for combat for at least 6 weeks, according to the magazine. I suspect that's probably a pretty good timetable, which would put us from the last week in January sometime into mid-March, which I'm also sorry to report that the Saddam meter on Slate Magazine went from 67%, something like that, chance of war. It's now well over 91%. And our sources on the web also tell us that the 101st Air Assault Division, based at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the Army's premier door kickers, have been given their deployment orders for the Gulf as of a couple days ago. And basically, the feeling is that when these guys are sending out, you know that war does appear imminent. So, Mr. McMillan, if you would be so good, why don't you cue up what we suspect is the Bush administration's theme?
Now this means war!
Fredonians going to war! Each native son will grab a gun and run away to war!
At last, we're going to war!
We're going to war! We're going to war!
At last, the country's going to war!
Is it? The country's going to war!
At last, the country's going to war!
We're going to war!
This is a fact we can't ignore!
We're going to war!
This is a fact we can't ignore!
We're going to war!
A friend of mine who has some kids sent me off the web that unfortunately going to have to perform for you with my limited musical ability, at least part of it. This is sung to the tune of, "If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. When you're happy and you know it, bomb Iraq. If you cannot find Osama, bomb Iraq. If the terrorists are frisky, Pakistan is looking shifty, North Korea is too risky, bomb Iraq. If you never were elected, bomb Iraq. If your mood is quite dejected, bomb Iraq. If you think Saddam's gone mad with the weapons that he had, and he tried to kill your dad, bomb Iraq. If your corporate fraud is growing, bomb Iraq. If your ties to it are showing, bomb Iraq. If your politics are sleazy, and hiding that ain't easy, and your manhood's getting queasy, bomb Iraq." Continuing our talk about Iraq, it appears that Colin Powell is out trying to convince the world or the UN or the U.S. public or whoever will listen that we really need to go in. It's time to go in. Interesting article I discovered was that a dossier presented by British Prime Minister Tony Blair to the Parliament was plagiarized from two articles and a September 2002 research paper submitted by a graduate student. It's worth noting that the Iraq described by the graduate student is not the Iraq of 2003, but the Iraq of 1991. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell praised and quoted that same British report in his presentation at the United Nations yesterday. Article out of the San Francisco Chronicle related to this same item, dated February 7th. A Monterey scholar says the British government lifted and distorted parts of his work for a report about how Iraq is fooling weapons inspectors. Ibrahim al-Mashiri of the Monterey Institute of International Studies said the British document's wording of certain passages was extremely close to his. It turns out that even his grammatical errors were lifted and put into the this so-called intelligence briefing presented to the British public. This has caused quite a stink, this story over in the UK. It's getting a little play over here. Anyway, those of you who are web literate may want to look up Mr. al-Marashi, al-marashi's paper. I'm sure you can find it on the web. It was very nice to come back from vacation and find some phone messages and emails saying they liked what we'd aired here on KDVS in the past few weeks. Someone did point out that I mispronounced the Secretary of Defense's name, Donald Rumsfeld. I think I said Rumsfeld once or twice, and of course my sound engineer edited it and said, you want to leave that in? I said, oh, no one will notice. Well, people did notice. But it is Donald Rumsfeld, and Mr. Rumsfeld has been out criticizing countries like France and Germany, jabbing them, saying that they were giving favor to Iraq, giving them by suggesting they have a chance to disarm. In doing this, he says, we are undermining what slim chance may exist to avoid war. So if my understanding on this is correct, the fact that they don't necessarily want to rush off to war is going to, in fact, promote war. Okay. The Economist had a wonderful little article about U.S. attitudes about Europeans and how we they're called by the right wing over here, Euroweenies, who never seem to learn. Back in 1965, the article notes, General Charles de Gaulle proclaimed that the United States is the greatest danger in the world today to peace. At a time when Vietnam War demonstrations were raging across Europe, There certainly is an anti-war feeling in Europe now that that I gather is fairly strong. And in the European view, the U.S. is behaving like a big bully. I think this is worth keeping in mind. So Tony Blair aside, there does seem to be a bit of a schism across the Atlantic Ocean among among NATO allies at the present time. We're calling them Euroweenies, and The Economist quoted an article in National Review describing the French as cheese-eating surrender monkeys. My. For their part, the Europeans seem to portray the U.S. as a nation of crazed gunslingers and religious fanatics. So, I don't know. It does seem that, in retrospect, that, you know, European leftists who wanted to, you know, line up with the Soviet Union against the U.S. look pretty... pretty out of step with the world today. But I think, nevertheless, it's good to keep in mind that that they may have a point or two in some of their criticism. And as part of our public affairs broadcasts here on KDVS, we would like to remind you that you may want to consider converging on the Capitol for a peace rally this Saturday, February 15th. It will be a meeting at the west and south steps of the state capitol, which is 10th Street and Capitol Avenue in Sacramento. There's planned activities from noon to 5 p.m., it looks like, and I would consider those of you who would be in sympathy of saying no to war to come out and, you know, stand up and be counted. We should talk about the shuttle and talk about the election over in Israel, but one article did strike me I wanted just to cite in brief. Because, again, reading The Economist, you know, it's a conservative publication, conservative magazine, business-oriented, but they do give you a lot of information compared to, like, Time magazine. You won't see seven-page exposés on the new Matrix movie in The Economist. They tend to be a little more intellectual. One little blurb that, again, caught my eye. In drought-struck Zimbabwe, the government ordered the official meteorological office to issue no more weather forecasts without clearing them with the presidency. I think it's worth mentioning because in the next month we're going to have someone from Zimbabwe and come on the show and talk about the deteriorating conditions in that beautiful country that I was privileged to visit some years ago. Very much like California, nice place, but currently being run into the ground by their president who fixed the election last year. Mugabe now insists on being called Comrade Mugabe, and apparently recently when motorists in a five-lane queue for fuel hooted and jeered at his motorcade as it sped by, he sent a truckload of troops to beat up those who had dared to insult him. And a new law was passed expressly forbidding any denigrating noises or motions being made at the presidential motorcade. This guy's bad news, and we're going to talk about him in the future. I don't know, I've got to quote from the following, because when you're in these former British colonies, these islands out in the Caribbean, and you're reading The Economist, I mean, it's so different than it is here. Article here, February 1st issue. All right, let me quote from this, about new reality television in the United States of America. If you thought things couldn't sink much lower than the Osbournes, think again. CBS, a television network, wants to take a real family from rural America, set them up in a Beverly Hills mansion, and broadcast the results. The television series behind CBS's premise was a huge hit in the 1960s. The Beverly Hillbillies starred the Clampetts, a fictional family from the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas. When the Klan struck it rich, they made off for California. Accompanying Patriarch Jed were his daughter, Ellie Mae, his nephew, Jethro, and his mother-in-law, Granny. CBS reckons that with a new series, viewers will be clutching their sides as the genuine hayseeds struggle to get to grips with money, power showers, and so forth. Imagine the episode where they have to interview maids, one executive is reported to have quipped. But not everyone is amused. I wish I could do a better British accent, but, you know, I think that pretty well sums it up. We are apparently going to have a new Beverly Hillbillies based on putting Hicks in Beverly Hills, and I have to join with The Economist. How low can things sink? And a lighter piece I probably should get into. We had the Super Bowl. While I was gone, I actually watched the Super Bowl on the island of Antigua, which for some reason the ex-British colonialists refer to as the island of Antigua. Go figure. Anyway, it was rather bizarre watching this extravaganza of American culture on a small island out in the Caribbean. I wish I'd put money on Tampa Bay. I thought John Gruden's team, Gruden being the former boss of the Raiders, was going to know everything they were going to do, and it certainly looked like he did. But an article in Fortune magazine caught my eye in the wake of the Super Bowl, complimenting the fact that the NFL attracts more viewers and makes more money than any other sport franchise in America, but pointing out that the rest of the world, and this is certainly true, looks at American football as a very strange phenomenon. And the article writer, Jeffrey Colvin, points out that it is such an American sport. For example, the league's 113-page rulebook specifies 67 possible penalties. Now, he points out that in this article, the U.S. tax code is far longer than the Bible. It's the sole source of employment for tens of thousands of lawyers and accountants. And analogously, football has more on-field officials, 7, than any other sport he's aware of. And the guy that wrote the article points out that, you know, it's a difficult admission for him, but, you know, don't Americans love legal drama? They seem to like heated arguments about whether the receiver was in the air, still in the end zone, had control of the ball before the defender pushed him out, etc. And it does seem to have the American character stamped all over it, football does. There's nothing else like it, and I guess that's why Americans love it so much. While on my vacation, I found that there are cyber cafes now just about everywhere. It's a different world than it was even 10 years ago. And you're pretty much can get online everywhere you go, it seems. So I checked my email when I was down on the island of Tobago off the Venezuelan coast. Found that NASA Science News, which I subscribe to, sent me a little update about the return of the Columbia. Noted that it would be visible over San Francisco, Northern California. So had I been here, I would have joined many of you who no doubt went up and watched the Columbia as it made its fatal return to Earth. It is interesting that a photographer in San Francisco apparently took a photo that NASA's trying to analyze very carefully, because in the past couple of years, we've discovered these really high atmospheric electrical phenomenons, red sprites and blue jets, these things that seem to be interactions between the ionosphere and lower in the atmosphere. There was some worry that the shuttle might interact with one of these electrical discharges, which people had sort of reported. Pilots had reported seeing above thunderclouds for years, but only recently were we able to get really good photographs of these and realize this is a real phenomenon. People had brought up the theoretical possibility that the shuttle might interact with one of these charges and be injured. And there is much thought of the three possible explanations currently in vogue about what happened to the Columbia. We all know that perhaps some of the insulation broke off the rocket and struck the wing, but people are doubtful that there was enough mass in the insulation to have injured the wing of the spacecraft. The two other possibilities are this electrical interaction, and this photographer in San Francisco took a photo that appears to show an electrical charge around the shuttle. So research will go on. I'm sure they will spend a lot of time poring over this and a lot of these photos that were taken of the re-entering spacecraft to see. The third possibility is that a bit of space junk struck the shuttle. Now, we've talked about this on the show before. The Earth is currently being orbited by thousands of objects, you know, in the cases of rocket boosters that have made its way into orbit. One time an astronaut on a spacewalk had his external glove separate. That's still up there orbiting the Earth and being tracked, by NORAD or by people in Colorado. But bits of paint will sometimes flake off a spacecraft and remain in orbit. Now, keeping in mind you're going like Mach 23 or something like that, a 30-odd-6 bullet, you know, travels at like Mach 2. So even a very small, you know, fleck of paint, smaller than a baby aspirin, you know, has basically the kinetic energy associated with it of a rifle bullet. So the possibility exists that the spacecraft may have been struck by a bit of orbiting junk which has been a concern of people for some time. In fact, there's some efforts now. New Scientist magazine reported in the January 2003 issue an effort to maybe get in to start finding a way to clear the litter out of the near space orbiting area. I think there's going to be a lot more attention focused on this in the future. But, you know, we still don't know. I believe in the end we will determine what happened to the shuttle. It may have just been a freak accident. There's certainly a huge national debate about what to do at this point. We have three people orbiting up in the International Space Station right now. And there's sort of two schools of thought. And I hate to say this, but it turns out I'm going to have to side with the rather conservative school of thought as to what to do here. I'm a great proponent of going into space. I think we should go to the moon. I think we should go to Mars, not because we're going to get any tremendous practical benefit out of doing this, but because, well, we may get some practical benefit out of it. You know, by studying the Martian atmosphere, we may learn a lot about what goes on here on Earth. Like I say, when you're inside the picture, sometimes it's when you're inside the frame, it's hard to see the picture. In fact, in the next couple segments, I'm going to talk a little bit about some science information that I was totally unaware of that kind of flabbergasted me that I learned in the past few weeks. But when it comes to space, the space shuttle is a problem. It has been a problem for a long time. When Richard Nixon became president, he basically was able to capitalize on the man who defeated him in 1960's vision, John Kennedy, who thought that we really needed to go to the moon by the end of the decade. This was a huge national focus. I think that, you know, college kids today listening to this, just you missed a fascinating, determined era back in the 1960s. And we were determined to use American technology to put a man on the moon and return him safely. Nixon was president when it finally happened on July 20th, 1969. The astronauts took a plaque with their signature and his signature on it and planted it on lunar soil. But no sooner had he reaped the public relations benefits of what Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson had very avidly pushed for than he set about basically, you know, chopping away at the Apollo program. He'd pretty much mined it for its political value and set about canceling Apollo missions. There were originally going to be 20 Apollo missions. He lopped off the last three and had NASA revamp its plans for going into space. Now, some people have said that if a committee had designed the horse, the result would have been the camel. And certainly the space shuttle was a camel among space vehicles. Time magazine had two conflicting essays I think we need to take a look at in its February 10th issue. The first by Hugh Sidney was titled, A Great Quest Takes Its Toll. His point was that when the Challenger blew up back in 1986, Ronald Reagan read a text by conservative speechwriter Peggy Noonan that said the Challenger crew was pulling us into the future and we'll continue to follow them. Well, I think we do, again, need to go into space. We should explore the planets. I mean, even if there was no other benefit from it, then it took aerospace money from the government and devoted it toward space exploration instead of bombs, that would be, in my mind, sufficient reason to go forward. But as we go forward, I'm sorry to say I'm much more in sync with the viewpoint expressed by Greg Easterbrook in the same issue of the magazine. Easterbrook is a senior editor at the New Republic and a visiting fellow of the Brookings Institution. 5 years before the Challenger, Easterbrook had written in the Washington Monthly that the shuttle's solid rocket boosters were not safe, and he certainly proved to be correct. It's a very critical essay, and I want to go over it in some detail, but we're up against it on time here, so let's take a short break and come back and give this the attention that it rightfully deserves. Hang on for the following messages. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. This is Radio Parallax.